That night at the station, I told Socrates my news. "Sock, I'm flying down to L.A. in a few days to visit my folks. I'm going to buy a motorcycle while I'm down there. And I just learned this afternoon that the United States Gymnastics Federation is flying Sid and me to Ljubljana, Yugoslavia, the World Gymnastics Championships." To my surprise, Socrates just frowned, saying, "What will be, will be." I chose to ignore this and started out the door. "Well, bye for now, Sock. See you in a few weeks." "I'll see you in a few hours," he responded. "Meet me at Ludwig's Fountain at noon." "Okay," I answered, wondering what was up. Then I said goodnight. I got 6 hours sleep and ran to the fountain just outside the Student Union. Ludwig's Fountain was named after a dog who used to frequent the spot. Several other dogs were romping and splashing there, cooling off from the August heat. A few little kids were wading in the shallow water. Just as the campanile, Berkeley's famous bell tower, began to chime the noon hour, I saw Sock's shadow at my feet. I was still a little sleepy. "Let's walk," he said. We strolled up through campus, past Sproul Hall, beyond the optometry school and Cowell Hospital, up beyond the football stadium into the hills of Strawberry Canyon. Finally, he spoke. "For you, Dan, a conscious process of transformation has begun. It cannot be reversed. There's no going back. To try and do so would end in madness. You can only go forward now. You're committed." "Ah, you mean like in an institution?" I tried to joke. He grinned. "There are similarities." We walked silently then, in the shade of the overgrown bushes, along the running path. "No one can help you beyond a certain point, Dan. I'll be guiding you for a while, but then even I must stand back, and you will be alone. You'll be tested severely before you're done. You'll have to develop great inner strength. I only hope it comes in time." The mild bay breeze had stopped and the air was hot. Still, I felt a chill. Shivering in the heat, I watched a lizard scurrying through the underbrush. Sock's last words had just registered. I glanced over at him. He was gone. Frightened, not knowing why, I hurried down the path. I didn't know it then, but my preparation had ended. My training was about to begin. And it was to begin with an ordeal I almost didn't survive. Chapter 4. The Sword is Sharpened. After storing the Valiant in a rented garage, I boarded the F bus to San Francisco, connecting with Airport Transit, which got caught in a traffic jam. It looked as if I'd be late for my flight. Anxious thoughts began to arise. I felt my belly tense. Then, as soon as I noticed it, I let it all go as I'd been trained. I relaxed and enjoyed the scenery along Bayshore Freeway, reflecting on my growing mastery over stressful thoughts, which had habitually plagued me in the past. And, as it turned out, I caught my plane with seconds to spare. Dad, an older version of me with thinning hair, wearing a bright blue sport shirt over his muscular chest, met me at the airport with a strong handshake and warm smile. Mom's face crinkled sweetly as she greeted me at the door of their apartment. All the while, I'd been tempted to tell them about my adventures with Socrates, but thought better of silence. Perhaps I'd explain it all in writing some day. I spent most of my time in Los Angeles looking for a motorcycle and finally found a 500cc Triumph. It took me a few days to get comfortable with it, and I almost fell twice, each time thinking I'd seen joy coming out of a store or disappearing around a corner. My final day in Los Angeles soon arrived. Early the next morning, I'd zoom up the coast to Berkeley, meet Sid that evening, and we'd take off for Yugoslavia and the World Gymnastics Championships. I relaxed around the house during the day. After dinner, I took crash helmet in hand and left the house to shop for a traveling bag. As I walked out the door, I heard Dad say, "Be careful, Dan. Motorcycles are hard to see at night." His usual caution. "Yeah, Dad, I'll be careful," I yelled back. Then I gunned the bike and pulled out into the traffic. I roared through the dusk. The streetlights flashed by as I approached 7th and Western. I was about to cut through the intersection when I noticed a red and white Buick facing me, signaling for a left turn. I slowed down, a small precaution which probably saved my life. Just as my bike entered the intersection, the Buick suddenly accelerated, turning directly in front of me. For a few more precious seconds, the body I was born with was still in one piece. There was time enough to think, but not to act. "Cut left," my mind screamed, but there was oncoming traffic. "Swerve right." I'd never clear the fender. "Lay it down." I'd slide under the wheels. My options were gone. I slammed on the brakes and waited. It was unreal, like a dream, until I saw a flashing image of the driver's horrified face. With a terrible thud and the musical sound of tinkling glass, my bike smashed into the car's front fender and my right leg shattered. Then everything sped up horribly as the world turned black. I must have lost and regained consciousness just after my body somersaulted over the car and crashed onto the concrete. A moment of blessed numbness, then the pain began, like a searing, red-hot vise, squeezing and crushing my leg tighter and tighter, until it became more than I could bear, and I started to scream. I wanted it to stop. I prayed for unconsciousness. Faraway voices. Just didn't see him. Parents' phone number? Take it easy. They'll be here soon. Then I heard a faraway siren, and hands were removing my helmet, lifting me onto a stretcher. I looked down and saw a white bone sticking out through the torn leather of my boot. With the slam of the ambulance door, I suddenly remembered Socrates' words, "And you'll be tested severely before you're done." Seconds later, it seemed, I was lying on the X-ray table in the emergency room of Los Angeles Orthopedic Hospital. The doctor complained of fatigue. My parents rushed into the room, looking very old and very pale. That's when reality caught up with me. Numb and in shock, I started to cry. The doctor worked efficiently, anesthetizing me, snapping my dislocated toes back into place, and sewing up my right foot. Later in the operating room, his scalpel sliced a long, red line deep into my skin, cutting through the muscles that had worked for me so well. He removed bone from my pelvis and grafted it to the fragments of my right thigh bone. Finally, he hammered a narrow metal rod down the center of my bone, from the hip, a kind of internal cast. I was semi-conscious for 3 days in a drug sleep that barely separated me from the agonizing, unrelenting pain. Sometime in the evening of the third day I awoke in darkness, when I sensed someone quiet as a shadow sitting nearby. Joy got up and knelt by my bedside, stroking my forehead as I turned away in shame. She whispered to me, "I came as soon as I heard." I wished for her to share my victories, but she always saw me in defeat. I bit my lip and tasted tears again. Joy gently turned my face to hers and looked into my eyes. "Socrates has a message for you, Danny. He asked me to tell you this story." I closed my eyes and listened intently. An old man and his son worked a small farm with only one horse to pull the plow. One day the horse ran away. How terrible, sympathized the neighbors. What bad luck. "Who knows whether it's bad luck or good luck," the farmer replied. A week later the horse returned from the mountains, leading 5 wild mares into the barn. "What wonderful luck," said the neighbors. "Good luck? Bad luck? Who knows?" answered the old man. The next day, the son, trying to tame one of the wild horses, fell and broke his leg. "How terrible! What bad luck!" "Good luck? Bad luck?" said the farmer. The army came to all the farms then to take the young men for war. The farmer's son, because of his broken leg, was of no use to them, so he was spared. "Good? Bad?" I smiled sadly as Joy finished the story, then bit my lip again as I was assaulted by a wave of pain. Joy soothed me with her voice. "There are no accidents, Danny. Everything is a lesson. Everything has a purpose. A purpose. A purpose," she repeated, whispering in my ear. "But my gymnastics, my training, it's over." "This is your training. The pain can purify the mind and body. It burns out many obstructions." She saw the questioning look in my eyes and added, "A warrior doesn't seek pain, but if pain comes, he uses it. Now rest, Danny, rest." She slipped out behind the entering nurse. "Don't go, Joy," I muttered, and fell into a deep sleep, remembering nothing more. Friends visited, and my parents came every day. But for most of 21 endless days, I lay alone, flat on my back, watching the white ceiling, meditating for hours, battered by thoughts of melancholy, self-pity, and futile hope. On a Tuesday morning, leaning on new crutches, I stepped out into the bright September sunlight and hobbled slowly to my parents' car. I had lost almost 30 pounds, and my pants hung loosely on my protruding hip bones. My right leg looked like a stick with a long purple scar down the side. I stayed with my parents for a few days, resting in the hot sun and swimming slowly through the shallow end of the swimming pool, painfully forcing my sutured leg muscles to work. I ate sparingly, fruits and vegetables, nuts, a little yogurt. I was beginning to regain my vitality. Friends invited me to stay with them for a few weeks at their home in Santa Monica, 5 blocks from the beach. I accepted, welcoming the chance to spend more time in the open air. Each morning I walked slowly to the warm sand and, laying my crutches down, sat by the waves. I listened to the gulls and the surf, then closed my eyes and meditated for hours, oblivious to the world around me. Berkeley, Socrates, and my past seemed lost in another dimension. Soon I began to exercise, slowly at first, then more intensely, until I was spending hours each day sweating in the hot sun, doing push-ups, sit-ups, curls. I carefully pressed up to handstands, then pumped up and down, again and again, puffing with exertion until every muscle had worked to its limit and my body glistened. Then I would hop one-legged into the shallow surf and sit dreaming of lofty somersaults until the salt water washed my shining sweat and soaring dreams into the sea. I had time to consider all that had happened to me since I had met Socrates. I thought about life and its purpose, death and its mystery, and I remembered my mysterious teacher, his words, his animated expressions. Mostly, though, I remembered his laughter. The warmth of the October sun faded into the November clouds. Fewer people came to the beach, and during this time of solitude, I enjoyed a peace I had not felt for many years. I imagined staying on the beach my whole life, but I knew I'd be going back to school after Christmas. My doctor gave me the results of my x-rays. "Your leg is healing well, Mr. Millman, unusually well, I should say. But I caution you, don't get your hopes up. The nature of your accident doesn't make it likely that you'll be able to do gymnastics again." I said nothing. Soon I waved goodbye to my parents and boarded a jet. It was time to return to Berkeley. Rick picked me up at the airport. I stayed with him and Sid for a few days until I found a studio in an old apartment house near campus. Each morning, gripping my crutches tightly, I'd make my way to the gym and train on the weight machines, then fall exhausted into the swimming pool. There, assisted by the water's buoyancy, I'd force my leg to the point of pain, trying to walk, always, always to the point of pain. Afterwards, I would lie on the lawn behind the gym, stretching my muscles to retain the suppleness I'd need for future training. Finally, I rested, reading in the library until I fell into a light sleep. I had called Socrates to tell him I was back. He wasn't much for talking on the phone and told me to visit him when I could walk without crutches. That was fine with me. I wasn't ready to see him yet. It was a lonely Christmas that year until Pat and Dennis, two of my teammates, knocked on my apartment door, grabbing me, grabbed my jacket, and practically carried me to the car. We drove toward Reno, up into the snow, and stopped at Donner Summit. While Pat and Dennis ran through the snow, wrestling, throwing snowballs, and sledding down the hill, I hobbled carefully through the snow and ice and sat on a log. My thoughts floated back to the coming semester and to the gymnastics room. I wondered if my leg would ever heal straight and strong. Snow dropped from a branch, thudding with a slushy sound to the frozen ground, waking me from my reverie. Soon we were driving home. Pat and Dennis were singing bawdy songs. I watched white crystals float down around us, glittering in our car's lights as the sun began to set. I thought about my derailed future and wished that I could leave my whirling mind behind me, buried in a white grave beside the road in the snowy mountains. Just after Christmas, I made a brief visit to L.A. to see my doctor, who let me trade in my crutches for a shiny black cane. Then I headed back to school and to Socrates. It was Wednesday night at 11:40 p.m. when I limped through the doorway of the office and saw Sock's radiant face. I was home again. I'd almost forgotten what it was like to sit and sip tea with Socrates in the quiet of the night. It was a more subtle and in many ways greater pleasure than all my athletic victories. I looked at this man who had become my teacher and saw things I'd never seen before. In the past, I had noticed a light that seemed to encircle him, but I'd assumed it was only my tired eyes. I wasn't tired now, and there was no doubt about it. It was a barely perceptible aura. "Socrates," I said, "there's a light shining around your body. What does it come from?" "Clean living," he grinned. Then the bell clanged, and he went out to make someone laugh under the pretext of servicing a car. Socrates dispensed more than gasoline. Maybe it was that aura, that energy or emotion. Anyway, people nearly always left happier than when they'd arrived. It wasn't the glowing, however, that impressed me most about him. It was his simplicity, his economy of motion and of action. I hadn't truly appreciated any of this before. It was as if I saw more deeply into Socrates with every new lesson I learned. As I came to see the complexities of my mind, I realized how he had already transcended his. When he returned to the office, I asked, "Socrates, where is Joy now? Will I see her again soon?" He smiled, as if glad to hear my questions again. "I don't know where she is. That girl is a mystery to me. Always was." I then told Socrates about the accident and its aftermath. He listened quietly and intently, nodding his head. "Dan, you're no longer the young fool who walked into this office over a year ago." "Has it been a year? It seemed like 10," I joked. "Are you saying I'm no longer a fool?" "No, only that you're no longer young." "Hey, that's real heartwarming, Sock. But now you're a fool with spirit, Dan, and that's a very big difference. You still have a faint chance of finding the gate and passing through." "Gate?" I said. "The gate exists inside you, and you alone must find it. I can only guide you. But you're not ready yet, not nearly ready. If you attempted to pass the gate now, it would mean your almost certain death. There's much work to be done before you're prepared to knock at the gate. To find the gate, you must first learn to follow the house rules," I volunteered. He laughed. Then the bell clanged as a car pulled smoothly through a rain puddle into the station. I watched through the misty window as Socrates walked quickly out into the drizzle, wearing his poncho. I could see him put the gas nozzle in, go around to the driver's side, and say something to a bearded, blonde-haired man in the car. The window misted over again, so I wiped it clean with my sleeve in time to see them laughing. Then Socrates opened the door to the office, and a draft of cold air slapped me harshly, bringing with it my first awareness that I didn't feel well at all. Socrates was about to make some tea when I said, "Please sit down, Sock. I'll make tea." He sat, nodding his head in approval. I leaned against the desk, feeling dizzy. My throat was sore. Perhaps the tea would help. As I filled the kettle and placed it on the hot plate, I asked, "Do I have to build some kind of road to this gate, then?" "Yes, in a sense, everyone must. You pave the way with your own work." Anticipating my next question, he said, "Anyone, any human being, male or female, young or old, has within the capacity to find the gate and pass through. But very few are moved to do so. Few are interested. This is very important. I didn't decide to teach you because of any inherent capacity you possessed. As a matter of fact, you have glaring weaknesses, along with your strong points. But you have the will to make this journey." That struck a resonant chord. "I guess you could compare it to gymnastics, Sock. Even someone who is overweight, weak, or inflexible can become a fine gymnast, but the preparation is longer, more difficult." "Yes, that's exactly what it's like. And I can tell you this, your path is going to be very steep." My head felt feverish, and I started to ache all over. I leaned against the desk again, and out of the corner of my eye saw Socrates come toward me, reaching out for my head. "Oh, no, not now. I'm not up to it," I thought. But he was only feeling my feverish forehead. Then he checked the glands in my neck, looked at my face and eyes, and felt my pulse for a long time. "Dan, your energies are way out of balance. Your spleen is probably swollen. I suggest you visit a physician. Tonight. Now." I was feeling really miserable by the time I limped to Cowell Hospital. My throat was burning, my body aching. The doctor confirmed Sock's diagnosis. My spleen was badly swollen. I had a severe case of mononucleosis and was admitted to the infirmary. During that first fitful, feverish night, I dreamed that I had one huge leg and one shriveled one. When I tried to swing on the bars or tumble, everything was crooked, and I fell into the late afternoon of the next day, when Socrates walked in with a bouquet of dried flowers. "Socrates," I said weakly, delighted by his unexpected visit. "You shouldn't have." "Yes, I should have," he replied. "I'll have the nurse put them in a vase. I'll think of you when I look at them," I grinned weakly. "They're not to look at, they're to eat," he said, leaving the room. A few minutes later, he returned with a glass of hot water. Crushing some of the flowers, he wrapped them in a piece of cheesecloth he'd brought and dipped the tea bag into the water. "This tea will strengthen you and help cleanse the blood. Here, drink. It tasted bitter. Strong medicine. Then he took a small bottle of yellow liquid in which were floating more crushed herbs and massaged the liquid deep into my right leg directly over the scar. I wondered what the nurse, a very pretty, businesslike young woman, would say if she came in. What is that yellow stuff in the bottle, Sock? Oh, urine, with a few herbs. Urine, I said, pulling my leg away from him with disgust. Don't be silly, he said, grabbing my leg and pulling it back. Urine is a very respected elixir in the ancient healing traditions. I closed my tired, aching eyes. My head was throbbing like jungle drums. I felt the fever starting to rise again. Socrates put his hand against my head, then felt the pulse in my wrist. Good, the herbs are taking effect. Tonight should be the crisis. Tomorrow you'll feel better. I managed a barely audible, thank you, Doc Sock. He reached over and put his hand on my solar plexus. Almost immediately, everything in my body intensified. I thought my head would explode. The fever started to burn me up. My glands pulsated. Worst of all was a terrible burning pain in my right leg at the site of the injury. Stop it, Socrates, stop it, I yelled. He took his hand away, and I collapsed onto the bed. I've just introduced a little more energy into your body than you're used to, he explained. It will accelerate the healing processes. It burns only where you have knots. If you were free of obstructions, if your mind was clear, your heart open, and your body free of tension, you'd experience the energy as an indescribable pleasure, better than sex. You'd think you were in heaven, and in a way, you'd be right. Sometimes you scare me, Socrates. The nurse walked in. Time to take your temperature, Mr. Milman. Socrates had risen politely when she entered. I lay in bed looking pale and miserable. The contrast between the two of us had never felt greater than at this moment. The nurse smiled at Socrates, who grinned back. I think your son is going to be just fine with a little rest, she said. Just what I keep telling him, Sock said. She smiled at him again. Was that a flirtatious look she gave him? With a rustle of white, she walked out of the room, looking blatantly appealing. Socrates sighed. Ah, there's something about a woman in uniform. Then he put his hand on my forehead. I fell into a deep sleep. The next morning I felt like a new man. The doctor's eyebrows rose as he checked my spleen, felt for my swollen glands, and rechecked my chart. He was dumbfounded. I can't find anything wrong with you, Mr. Milman. He sounded almost apologetic. You can go home after lunch. Get plenty of rest. He walked out, staring at my chart. The nurse rustled by again. Help, I yelled. Yes, she said, stepping inside. I can't understand it, nurse. I think I'm having heart trouble. Every time you go by, my pulse gets erratic. Don't you mean erratic, she said. Oh, whatever. Smiling at me, she said, it sounds like you're ready to go home. That's what everyone keeps telling me, but you're all mistaken. I'm sure I'll need private nursing care. Smiling invitingly, she turned and walked away. Nurse, don't leave me, I cried. That afternoon, walking home, I was astonished by the improvement in my leg. I still limped badly, throwing my hip out to the side whenever I took a step, but I could almost walk without my cane. Maybe there was something to Sock's magic urine treatment or the battery charge he had given me. School had begun, and I was again surrounded by other students and books and assignments, but that was all secondary to me now. I could play the game without concern. I had much more important things to do in a small gas station west of campus. After a long nap, I walked to the station. The moment I sat down, Sock said, "Lots of work to do." Oh, what is that, I said, stretching and yawning. A complete overhaul. Oh, a big job. Especially big. We're going to overhaul you. Oh, yeah, I said. Oh, hell, I thought. Like the phoenix, you're going to throw yourself into the fire and rise from your ashes. I'm ready, I said. For my New Year's resolution, I'm going to give up donuts. Socrates grinned at me, saying, I wish it were that simple. Right now, you're a tangled mass of twisted circuits and outmoded habits. You're going to have to change habits of acting, of thinking, of dreaming, and of seeing the world. Most of what you are is a series of bad habits. He was starting to get to me. Damn it, Socrates. I've overcome some difficult hurdles, and I'm still doing the best I can. Can't you show me some respect? Socrates threw back his head and laughed. Then he walked over to me and pulled my shirt out. As I was tucking it back in, he mussed up my hair. Listen to me, oh great buffoon. Everyone wants respect. But it is not just a matter of saying, please respect me. You must earn respect by acting respectable, and the respect of a warrior is not easily earned. I counted to 10, then asked, "How then am I going to earn your respect?" "By changing your act." "What act is that?" "Your poor me act, of course. Stop being so proud of mediocrity. Show some spirit." Grinning as usual, Socrates jumped up and slapped me playfully on my cheek. Then he poked me in the ribs. "Stop it," I yelled, in no mood for his play. I reached out to grab his arm, but he leaped lightly up on the desk. Then he leaped over my head, spun, and pushed me backwards onto the couch. Climbing angrily to my feet, I tried to push him back, but just as I touched him, he leaped backward over the desk. I fell forwards onto the carpet. "God damn it," I raged, seeing red. He slipped out the door into the garage. I limped after him in pursuit. Socrates perched on a fender and scratched his head. "Why, Dan, you're angry." "Stunning observation," I fumed, panting heavily. "Good," he said. "Considering your predicament, you should be angry. But make sure you direct that anger wisely." Soc deftly began to change the spark plugs on a VW. "Anger is one of your main tools to transform old habits." He removed an old plug with the spark plug wrench and replaced them with new ones. He threaded a new plug into the block, tightening it with a firm tug of the wrench. "Anger can burn away old habits. Fear and sorrow inhibit action, you see. Anger generates it. When you learn to make proper use of your anger, you can transmute fear and sorrow to anger, and anger to action. That's your body's secret of internal alchemy." Back in the office, Socrates drew some water from the spring water dispenser and put on the evening's tea specialty, rose hips, as he continued. "You have many habits that weaken you. The secret of change is to focus all your energy not on fighting the old, but on building the new." "How can I control my habits if I can't even control my emotions, Sock?" He sat back in his chair. "It is like this. When your mind creates a problem, when it resists life as it unfolds in the moment, your body tenses and feels this tension as an emotion, variously interpreted by words like fear, sorrow, or anger. True emotion, Dan, is pure energy flowing freely in the body. Sometimes it's appropriate to express fear, sorrow, or anger, but the energy should be directed completely outward, not held in. The expression of emotions should be complete and powerful, then should vanish without a trace. The way to control your emotions, then, is to let them flow, then let them go." I got up, took the whistling kettle off the hot plate, and poured our steaming tea. "Can you give me a specific example, Socrates?" "All right, then," he said. "Spend time with a baby." Smiling, I blew on my tea. "Funny, I never thought of babies as masters of emotional control." "When a baby is upset," he said, "it expresses itself in banshee wails, pure crying. It doesn't wonder about whether it should be crying. Hold or feed that baby, and within seconds, no more tears. If the baby is angry, then it very definitely lets you know. But this, too, it lets go of very quickly. Can you imagine a baby's feeling guilty about its anger? Babies let it flow, then let it go. They express themselves fully, then shut up. Infants are fine teachers, and they demonstrate the right use of energy. Learn that, and you can transform any habit." A Ford Ranchero wagon pulled into the station. Socrates went around to the driver's seat, while I, chuckling, grabbed the gas hose and removed the gas cap. Inspired by his enlightening revelation of how to control emotions, I yelled over the roof of the car, "Just tell me what to do, and set me loose, Sock. I'll tear those nasty habits to shreds." Then I got a look at the passengers, three shocked nuns. I choked on my words and, turning beet red, busied myself with washing the windows. Socrates just leaned against the pump and buried his face in his hands. After the ranchero pulled out, much to my relief, another customer drove in. It was the blonde man again, the one with the curly beard. He jumped out of the car and gave Socrates a bear hug. "Good to see you as always, Joseph," Socrates said. "Same here. Socrates, isn't it?" He gave me a beguiling grin. "Joseph, this young question machine is named Dan. Push a button and he asks a question. Marvelous to have around, really, when I've no one to talk to." Joseph shook my hand. "Has the old man mellowed in his declining years?" he asked with a broad smile. Before I could assure him that Soc was probably more ornery than ever, the old man interrupted. "Oh, I've really become lazy. Dan has it much easier than you did." Oh, I see, Joseph said, maintaining a serious countenance. You haven't taken him on any 100-mile runs or worked with the burning coals yet, hm?
No, nothing like that. We're just about to start with the basics, like how to eat, walk, and breathe.
Joseph laughed merrily. I found myself laughing with him.
Speaking of eating, he said, why don't both of you come to my cafe this morning? You'll be my private guests, and I'll whip up something for breakfast.
I was just about to say, oh, I'd like to, but I really can't, when Socrates volunteered, we'd be delighted. The morning shift gets on in half an hour. We'll walk over.
Great. See you then.
He handed Sock a $5 bill for the gas and drove off.
I wondered about Joseph.
Is he a warrior like you, Sock?
No one is a warrior like me, he answered, laughing.
Nor would anyone want to be. Every man or woman has natural qualities. For example, while you've excelled in gymnastics, Joseph has mastered the preparation of food.
Oh, you mean cooking?
Not exactly. Joseph doesn't heat food much. He prepares natural foods in a way you'll see for yourself. After a taste of Joseph's culinary magic, you'll have no tolerance for fast food joints ever again.
What's so special about his cooking?
Only two things, really, both subtle. First, he gives his complete attention to what he does. Second, love is literally one of the primary ingredients in everything he makes. You can taste it afterwards for a long time.
Sock's replacement, a lanky teenager, came in with his usual grunted greeting. We left, crossed the streets, and headed south.
My limping pace quickened to keep up with Sock's strides as we took the scenic route down side streets, avoiding early morning rush hour traffic. While we walked, we talked. Socrates began, Dan, a tremendous amount of energy is necessary to cut through the mists of your mind and find the gate. We're going to clean you out, take you apart, and put you back together again. You're going to readapt your every human function, moving, sleeping, breathing, thinking, feeling, and eating. Of all the human activities, eating is one of the most important to stabilize first.
Wait a minute, Socrates. Eating isn't really a problem area for me. I'm slim. I generally feel pretty good, and my gymnastics proves I have enough energy. How is changing a few things in my diet going to make a difference?
Your present diet, he said, glancing up through the sunlit branches of a beautiful tree, may give you a normal amount of energy. But much of what you eat also makes you groggy, affects your moods, lowers your level of awareness, and interferes with your body's optimal vitality. Your impulsive diet results in toxic residues that have a long-range effect on your longevity. Most of your mental and emotional problems could be minimized by simple attention to proper eating.
How can changing my diet affect my energy, I argued. I mean, I take in calories, and they represent a certain amount of energy.
That is the traditional view, but it is a shallow one. The warrior must recognize more subtle influences. Our primary source of energy in this system, he said, waving his arm to indicate the solar system, is the sun. A proper diet allows you to make the most direct use of the sun's energy. The ensuing store of energy will open your senses, expand your awareness, and sharpen your concentration into a slashing blade.
All that is going to happen by eliminating cupcakes from my diet?
Yes, by eliminating cupcakes and a few other odds and ends.
Well, one of the Japanese Olympic gymnasts once told me that it's not your bad habits that count, but your good ones.
That means your good habits must become so strong that they dissolve those which are not useful.
Socrates pointed ahead to a small cafe on Shattuck, near Ashby.
I'd walked there many times without really noticing it.
So you believe in natural foods, Sock? I said as we crossed the street.
It's not a matter of believing, but of doing. I can tell you this. I eat only what is wholesome, and I eat only as much as I need. In order to appreciate what you call natural foods, you have to sharpen your instincts. You have to become a natural man.
Sounds positively ascetic to me. Don't you ever have a little ice cream now and then?
My diet, he said, may at first seem Spartan compared to the indulgences you call moderation, but the way I eat is actually filled with pleasure, because I've developed the capacity to enjoy the simplest foods, and so will you.
We knocked on the door, and Joseph opened it.
Come in, he said enthusiastically, as if welcoming us to his home.
It did, in fact, look like a home.
Morning light poured through a skylight overhead. We sat directly below it, in the warm rays of the sun, occasionally shaded by clouds drifting overhead.
Joseph approached us, carrying two plates over his head. With a flourish, he placed them in front of us, serving Socrates first, then me.
Ah, it looks delicious, said Socrates, tucking his napkin around the neck of his shirt. I looked down.
there before me on a white plate were a sliced carrot and a piece of lettuce. I stared at it in consternation. At my expression, Socrates almost fell out of his chair laughing, and Joseph had to lean against a table. "Ah," I said with a sigh of relief, "it is a joke, then." Without another word, Joseph took the plates and returned with two beautiful wooden bowls. In each bowl was a perfectly carved miniature replica of a mountain. The mountain itself was a blended combination of cantaloupe and honeydew melon. Small chunks of walnuts and almonds, individually carved, became brown boulders. The craggy cliffs were made from apples and thin slices of cheese. The trees were made of many pieces of parsley, each pruned to a perfect shape, like bonsai trees. An icing of yogurt capped the peak. Around the base were halved grapes and a ring of fresh strawberries. I sat and stared. "Joseph, it's too beautiful. I can't eat this. I want to take a picture of it." Socrates, I noticed, had already begun eating, nibbling slowly, as was his manner. I attacked the mountain with gusto and was soon done. When Socrates suddenly started gobbling up his food, I realized he was mimicking me. I did my best to take small bites, breathing deeply between each bite as he did, but it seemed frustratingly slow. "The pleasure you get from eating, Dan, is limited to the taste of the food and the feeling of a full belly. You must learn to enjoy the entire process, the hunger beforehand, the careful preparation, setting an attractive table, chewing, breathing, smelling, tasting, swallowing, and the feeling of lightness and energy after the meal. Finally, you can enjoy the full and easy elimination of the food after it's digested. When you pay attention to all these elements, you'll begin to appreciate simple meals. You won't need as much food. The irony of your present eating habits is that while you fear missing a meal, you aren't fully aware of the meals you do eat." "I'm not afraid of missing a meal," I argued. "I'm glad to hear that," he said. "It will make the coming week easier for you. This meal is the last one you'll be having for the next 7 days." Sock then proceeded to outline a purifying fast that I was to begin immediately. Diluted fruit juice or plain herb teas were to be my only fare. "But Socrates, I need my protein and iron to help my leg heal. I need my energy for gymnastics." It was no use. Socrates could be a very unreasonable man. We helped Joseph with a few chores, talked for a while, thanked him, and left. I was already hungry. While we walked back toward campus, Socrates summarized the disciplines I was to follow until my body regained its natural instincts. "In a few years, there will be no need for rules. For now, however, you're to eliminate all food that contains refined sugar, refined flour, meat, and eggs, as well as drugs including coffee, alcohol, tobacco, or any other non-useful food. Eat only fresh, unrefined, unprocessed foods. In general, make breakfast a fresh fruit meal, maybe with a little cottage cheese or yogurt. Your lunch, your main meal, should be a raw salad, baked or steamed potato, and whole grain bread or cooked grains. Dinner should be a raw salad, and on occasion, lightly steamed vegetables. Make good use of raw, unsalted seeds and nuts." "I guess by now you're quite an expert on nuts, Sock," I grumbled. On the way home, we passed by a neighborhood grocery store. I was about to go inside and get some cookies when I remembered that I was no longer allowed to eat store-bought cookies for the rest of my life, and for the next 6 days and 23 hours, I wouldn't be eating anything at all. "Socrates, I'm hungry." "I never said that the training of a warrior would be a piece of cake," he replied. We walked through campus just between classes, so Sproul Plaza was filled with people. I gazed wistfully at the pretty co-eds. Socrates touched my arm. "That reminds me, Dan. Culinary sweets aren't the only indulgence you're going to have to avoid for a while." "Uh-oh," I stopped dead in my tracks. "I want to make very sure I don't misunderstand you. Can you be more specific, Sock?" "Sure I can," he replied. "While you may of course enjoy intimate, heartfelt relationships, until you are sufficiently mature, you are to refrain completely from your preoccupation with sexual release. To spell it out for you, keep it in your pants." "But Sock," I argued, as if on trial for my life, "that's old-fashioned, puritanical, unreasonable, and unhealthy. Cutting down on food is one thing, but this is different." I started quoting the Playboy philosophy, Albert Ellis, Robert Rimmer, Jacqueline Suzanne, and the Marquis de Sade. I even threw in Reader's Digest and Dear Abby, but nothing moved him. He said, "There's no point in my trying to explain my reasons. You're just going to have to find your future thrills in fresh air, fresh foods, fresh water, fresh awareness, and sunshine." "How can I possibly follow every discipline you demand?" Consider the final words of advice that Buddha gave to his disciples. What did he say? I waited inspiration. "Do your best." With that, Sok vanished into the crowd. The next week, my rites of initiation got underway. While my stomach growled, Sok filled my nights with basic exercises, teaching me how to breathe more deeply and slowly, mouth lightly closed and the tongue on the roof of the mouth. I plodded on, doing my best, feeling lethargic, looking forward to my, diluted fruit juice and herb tea, dreaming about steaks and sweet rolls, and I didn't even particularly like steaks or sweet rolls. He told me to breathe with my belly one day and to breathe with my heart the next. He began to criticize my walking, my talking, the way my eyes wandered around the room as my mind wandered around the universe. Nothing I did seemed to satisfy him. Over and over he corrected me, sometimes gently, sometimes harshly. "Proper posture is a way of blending with gravity, Dan. Proper attitude is a way of blending with life." And so it went. The third day of the fast was the hardest. I was weak and cranky. I had headaches and bad breath. All part of the purification process, Dan. Your body is cleaning out, getting rid of stored toxins. At workout, all I did was lie around and stretch. I was actually feeling good, even cocky, the seventh day of the fast. I felt I could go longer. My hunger had disappeared long before. All I felt in its stead was a pleasant lassitude and feeling of lightness. Workouts actually improved. Limited only by my weak leg, I trained hard, feeling relaxed and more supple than ever. When I started eating on the eighth day, beginning with very small amounts of fruit, I had to use all my willpower not to start gorging myself on whatever I was allowed to eat. Socrates tolerated no complaints, no backtalk. In fact, he didn't want me to talk at all unless it was absolutely necessary. "No more idle jabbering," he said. "What comes out of your mouth is as important as what goes into it." I was thus able to censor the inane comments that used to make me appear a fool. It actually felt pretty good to talk less once I started getting the knack of it. I felt calmer somehow. But after a few weeks, I tired of it. My main problem was fitting in socially with my friends. Rick, Sid, and I took dates to Laval's for pizza. Everyone else, including my date, shared an extra-large sausage pizza. I ordered a small, whole-wheat, vegetarian special. They had milkshakes or beer. I sipped my apple juice. They wanted to go to Fenton's ice cream parlor afterward. While they ate their sundaes, I sucked on a piece of ice. I looked at them enviously. They looked back with vague resentment. I probably made them feel guilty. My social life was collapsing under the weight of my disciplines. I would walk blocks out of my way to avoid the donut shops, food stands, and outdoor restaurants near campus. My cravings and compulsions were becoming obvious to me, but I fought back. If I turned into a jellyfish over a jelly donut, I just wouldn't be able to face Socrates. As time passed, though, I began to feel a growing resistance. I complained to Socrates, in spite of his dark look. "Sock, you're no fun anymore. You've become an ordinary grumpy old man. You never even glow." He glowered at me. "No more magic tricks." That was just it. No tricks, no sex, no potato chips, no hamburgers, no candy, no donuts, no fun, and no rest. Discipline in the station and out. January had trudged by. February had flown, and now March was nearly over. The team was finishing the season without me. Again I told Socrates my feelings, but he offered no consolation, no support. "Socrates, I'm a real spiritual Boy Scout. My friends don't want to go out with me anymore. You're ruining my life. I'm afraid I'll become a dried-up old..." Socrates interrupted me. "Dan, if dehydration is what you fear, I can assure you that my late wife considered me rather juicy." "Your wife?" He laughed again at my shocked expression. Then he looked at me. I thought he wanted to say something else, but he only resumed his paperwork and said, "Do your best." "Well, thank you for the stirring pep talk." Deep down, I was offended by having another person, even Socrates, direct my life.